Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players, as we explore tone and the gear that gets it. And now, here are your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. This is the Flow here. I'm here with Scott. How you doing?
I am doing good, Jeff. How was your holiday weekend for Labor Day?
It went way too fast, but it was good. It was nice and quiet. It was a quiet weekend.
Excellent. So what have you been up to? I've been in the studio.
Fooling around with, been rewiring. I'm doing rewiring in the studio, and so far so good. It's sounding great. No noise. Our guests would be happy to know that there's no loss of signal. But yeah, I've been just working on that. It's kind of hard to explain what I'm doing, but I'm changing my whole patch bay and stuff. So.
Ah, very cool. Well, I just want to remind our listeners that if you're listening live, you will be able to call in later and ask our guest question. Also, we are giving away the CAE MXR 402 Boost Overdrive in the middle of the show, so you have about 20 to 25 minutes to still sign up for it. You can go to our website, www.flowguitarenthusiast.com.
And it's personally signed. We witnessed it.
Yeah, I just got our guest, Bob Bradshaw, to sign it.
Yes.
So a while back, I actually about a couple of weeks ago, I did a video on Taylor guitar, Taylor T3B. And we actually have Aaron DeBlow from Taylor Guitars on with us to talk about that guitar. Aaron, are you there?
Aaron?
Hey, yeah.
There we go.
How's it going, guys? How's it going?
Yeah, can you tell us about how the Taylor T3B came about?
Sure thing, no problems. You guys are obviously familiar with the Taylor T5, right? The acoustic electric hybrid that we put out in 2005. And won all sorts of awards for acoustic guitar of the year, electric guitar of the year. So it was a really true hybrid guitar that did great acoustic and electric sounds, you know, completely analog with, you know, just nothing but magnets and wires. There were some players who loved the sound of that guitar, but they didn't need the acoustic body sensor. Like, okay, well Taylor's making an awesome electric guitar now. And they didn't need the body sensor to produce the acoustic tone. So you guys may or may not be familiar with the T5 that showed two exposed single coil pickups. You might see them here and there. They're still in some stores if you can find them. You may rarely see one of those pop up on eBay or not. But those guitars were for the player that didn't need the acoustic tone. So it completely took away that acoustic body sensor and slapped in another, like a neck pickup. And so it was a T5 that had five-way switching for basically electric tones. So, well, you know, we just thought, well, let's just make an electric guitar then. So that's how the T3 was born. So it's basically the exact same thing as a T5, same dimension, same scale length, same everything, but it's just blocked down the center, you know, to house whatever pickups you want, whether it's our HD pickups or our HG high gain pickups or our vintage Alnicos, and then it's equipped to house either Stop Taylor or Bigsby vibrato. So that's kind of where it came about. Players loved the T5 but wanted you know, just to use the electric side. They're like, well, let's just make a full on electric guitar, a semi hollow body that does all of that. So,
well, I was going to ask you with the Taylor, the T3B, it was it a coincidence? I mean, it seems like when you, because the guitar does split coils, which is really cool when you have the humbuckers. And when you pull that up,
right,
and you split the coils for the humbuckers, and then you also pull up the tone knob, the guitar really sounds like an acoustic electric. Was that on purpose, or is it just a happy accident?
Yeah, I think it was just a happy accident, something just coming together like that. I mean, our HD pickups, I'm assuming that's what's in your T3, right, Scott? It doesn't have, like, your pickups don't have the big slug pieces. It's, like, just the regular size pole pieces, I'm assuming, correct? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you got our, you know, the standard HD high-definition pickup. So I'm just assuming, you know, it's just a completely, I don't want to use the word sterile, but, you know, it's like a very pure electric guitar signal. So I think if you split those, it just kind of happened to where, you know, it's just a really clean, chimey sound. And you're right, it's very versatile, it's a very usable tone, and I agree with you. I also own one. I love that sound where you split the chords and then you also pull up the tone knob to get like just your regular, we have our tone capacitors. It's kind of a dual purpose. If you have it in the down position, if you roll it all the way off, you get like that peak mid, like a notch wah pedal. And that's what you find inherently in our solid body. So it's kind of like a dual feature type of tone knob. But if you pull the knob up, that's your classic tone control. You know, like you roll it all the way off, it just kind of, increases or rolls off the treble, increases the mids and bass, that sort of thing. So it worked out well. Yeah, if you pull them both up at the same time, it's very usable, very cool guitar tone.
What's the wood that you guys actually have as your center block piece of wood? What kind of wood is that? Is that the Sapelli?
Yeah. The back, the whole back is routed out. If you're familiar with the T5, the whole thing is, you know, we just have one big block of Sapelli, and we route it out for the T5. Same thing with the T3, but it's routed to, you know, it's on each side, bass and treble, bow side. So you have, like, the center block that will house the pickups.
Very cool. And then you guys do all kinds of different tops with it, right? I've seen the Curly Maples one that I have, and then you guys have done walnut, all kinds of different things. How thick is that top, the cap? Is it thick as like a standard like Les Paul set of quarter inch or?
It'd be more like an eighth. It's 0.125, so that equates about an eighth of an inch top. So yeah, you're right. We do them in all sorts of crazy finishes. I've seen a pink sparkle one. You know, we do them with Cocobolo and flame maple as well as quilted. You're right. You've seen walnut. We'll do Macassar ebony. You know, so there's some really cool looking T3s out there.
Very cool. Well, if you guys want to learn more about the T3B, you can just go to www.taylorguitars.com.
Yeah, I just want to mention that we have the guitar here. We show it to a lot of people when we're doing the show, and Jason Sine just loved that chimey acoustic type of sound. He really commented. I think we have a video of that.
Yeah,
posted.
I have that up on, and then also, Billy Sheehan fell in love
with
the guitar too.
He liked it too.
Which he's, by the way, anyone knows, he's a heck of a guitar player, actually.
So. Yes.
But have to be the way he plays
bass.
That's
awesome. Thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, keep showing that thing off, Scott. I appreciate it.
No problem. All right, well, thanks a lot, Aaron. We really appreciate you coming on the show.
Yes.
Yeah, always a pleasure. We'll talk to you guys soon.
All right, thanks.
All right, have a good night.
Thanks.
Okay, let's get on with our show. We got a lot to talk about. I first heard about Bob when I was in college, because I was in school and a couple years ahead of me, Lee Ritenour was there, and he was talking about building his first system. And this whole big system with a stack of rack mount modules and a bunch of effects pedals. And just the list of people that Bob has worked with is just mind-boggling in building custom setups. And started out, I think, with Buzzy Featon, and then also still doing a lot of work with Mike Landau. But you've done stuff for Joe Perry, for Steve Stevens, even one setup for Eddie Van Halen, just a bunch of people, and Edge. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on, and all these people. So without further ado, it's truly an honor to have here Bob Bradshaw. Hey, Bob, how you doing?
I'm good. How's everybody doing there in Radio Land?
Great. Give us a little background how you got started in this. It's kind of interesting where I was reading your story on the website, by the way, mm-hmm. Which is www.customaudioelectronics.com. And just give us a little background how you got into this, and because you've pioneered a lot of major things now that are kind of common in the industry now, like true bypass, and you were doing amp switching and all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. Give us a little bit of that.
Well, it all started from a love of music. Okay. I got into music, and I was the kid with the biggest stereo on the block, you know. I didn't know how to work on any of that stuff. But I made 8-track tapes for all my friends. I recorded them back when we were, you know, 8-tracks were big. And I grew up in Florida, and I went to electronics school in Atlanta, Georgia, at the DeVry Institute of Technology. Woo! And you know, off the back of a matchbook cover, you know. And I'd been out of high school a couple of years, and my parents were going, "Well, hey, what are you gonna do?" You know, and I'd never had any friends that were in bands or anything back then that I could like help out or anything. It was all I had a burning desire to get into the music business somehow, and I figured, well, maybe the best shot would be to go to electronic school first, get a little background or something, and then get into it somehow. I wanted to be like a live sound engineer or something like that. You know, I'd go to shows with my friends, and I'd be standing there staring at these dudes tearing the stage apart and everything, wondering how the hell do you get into that, you know. So that's what I did. I went to school, electronic school in Atlanta, Georgia, and it wasn't even a degree program or anything. It was like a technician course. And Hughes Aircraft bought me and brought me out to California. And then I had to put in time for them for a year because they brought me out there. And then I found an ad in the newspaper, in the Recycler or something like that, for a place called Musician Service Center. And it was a place that fixed stuff. So I applied there, and the guy hired me. I had no idea what I was working on, but I had a knowledge. I was a big reader. I had subscriptions to every magazine that had anything to do with audio at the time, and I was just wanted to get into it somehow. And this was my first in. So here I am, thrust into working on all kinds of musical instrument stuff, and what you have to go on are like service manuals and schematics. And just by my intuitive knowledge, I, you know, got into it. And I'd be working on all kinds of stuff. People bring in all kinds of amps and stuff. I worked on amps for, it's so funny because Rick Kelly, a friend of mine, worked for Gary Richrath with the REO Speedwagon. And we were just talking about this just the other day because he helps out Dave Mason now and again now. And Dave is a client of mine. Friend, and we were talking about him bringing in Gary Richrath's 50 watt Marshalls, and I remember working on them back then. So we would start working on stuff, and I would there was another guy in the back that was doing Fender Rhodes mods and stuff, and occasionally pedal boards would come in, and he would work on those. And he was I would see these pedal boards come in that Paul Rivera made. Paul Rivera at the time was the guy in town who built pedal boards and stuff for all the studio guys and all the a lot of the Southern California based rocker dudes and everything that were into pedals and multiple effects and things like that. He built all the stuff, and he had great ideas, but he had a certain specific way he did things. And he would take and he would modify the pedals. Back then, it was things like MXR pedals that didn't have an LED in them for status indication. You wouldn't know whether they're on or off. And he would modify them, put a power jack on them. A lot of them didn't. They didn't even have power jacks.
Yeah,
back
that's right.
Then. Back it was then. All batteries. And so he would put a DIN connector on the front side of these things that would supply power, and he would put LEDs in them and stuff too, so you could see what you're doing. And I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. That's interesting, but in the meantime, there was a series of articles in Guitar Player magazine by Craig Anderton, who is my guru. Really, this guy set about describing an idea for a switching system where you had routing loops and such. And that was the seed that got me going. And I thought, man, that's a good idea. Why step on all of these different pedals? Now, at the time, there were Boss pedals. I got to tell you, there wasn't any rack mount stuff at the time. There was no pedals. There was no rack mount gear or anything. All the rack mount stuff was in studio gear, you know, in studios. Being in L.A., you're surrounded by studios. So that comes into play later. But anyway, why not have a board that you've got a light and a switch in a uniform fashion that you step on, rather than all these different switches. You had a Boss pedal with a weird switch, and a Mutron with a weird switch. MXRs all had different switches, all this different stuff, all these different pedals. And I always thought, God, it's so distracting to see a guy bending down and tweaking on his pedals and everything down in front of him. Why not get that stuff off the ground behind you or something in some form, you know? And I didn't even know what racks were back then. I didn't know any of that kind of stuff. Well, there's got to be some way better to do this. Get it off the ground at least. And so I started from that seed that I got from those. There's like three of them, and I still have them to this day. Cut out. I'm gonna frame them. I should put them up. You know. So it's like the inspiration for stuff. And so I go, I gotta come up with something like this. And I'm doing this at home. See. And I start working on these different circuits and these routing circuits. And I've had all of these different styles of audio routing, from discrete field effect transistors, are called FETs, discrete FETs, to IC packages and stuff to do it. And relays came later, which everybody does now. It's all relays because everybody wants, you know, passive signal path and blah, blah, blah. But back then it was a little different. And so I start coming up with these ideas where I've got a switch now that turns on a light, and it turns on this switch and these two different pieces, a foot switch and then another piece. And if you were to see the first switchers, they were in these, I forget the name of the company. It wasn't Bud Boxes, but it was somebody that made sort of a rack mount thing. But I didn't even mount the switches on the back. I mounted the switches in the top of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was weird, but it worked. And I'm working on local musicians' gear who I met through Musician Service Center, and I've done some pretty elaborate things for different guys, but nothing that was really what the system was to become. So I then, one of my favorite guitar players on the planet to this day is Buzzy Featon. And he's a great guy. He's not ground zero when it comes to the stuff that I built, because I built stuff for so few other people. But really, in a sense, you could call him, pretty much in a professional sense, he is my ground zero. And I met him at a club show in at the Fleetwood or something in Redondo Beach years ago. And I was too shy to go up to him. I had my girlfriend at the time go back, meet him, say, she comes back out to me in this club. She goes, Buzzy wants to meet you. Come back here right now. And she was really cute, so she had it going on. So, you know, got his attention, you know. He comes back, and here I am meeting my hero, and I'm like speechless. But he was super cool. I told him what I was trying to do, and he was open to it. And from that time, we started a relationship that, you know, really, I haven't done much for him lately, but I spoke to him fairly recently. And, to this day, you know, we still have a friendship, which is really cool, you know, which is great. Anyway, the guy is a seeker, man, and he was always changing his stuff around, but it was into effects. And so we had this relationship where I could try practically anything I wanted to try. Meanwhile, things were coming thick and fast to me of changing things, and it's all totally there's no internet back then. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. You're all going by your seat of your pants and learning what I gleaned from basic knowledge and basic electronic knowledge that I got all on my own. This was got nothing from nobody. This is all, the only thing that I got was a spark of an idea for a routing loop from Craig Anderton. It all from there. The foot controller and everything, it all started out individual switches. This is even prior to even having presets.
So Bob, let me ask, how did you handle power for the pedals back then? Because you don't have like a Voodoo Labs power brick.
No, that's
like
true.
That.
No, there was just various little wall warts that you would use, and that's all. I
think there were like Radio Shack make little 9-volt.
I built. I remember. Yeah, but I remember I built power jacks into the top of my box. I had a power supply that powered the circuitry in the box, and at the same time, let's hang out whatever voltages are needed for the pedals. Usually 9 volts, sometimes different. You know, it might be 15 volts or something. So it varied. But yeah, it was pretty much all integrated into one box, power and audio routing and stuff. But the cool thing was, you've got a separate foot controller with it, all of like-minded switches, with an LED for each, and there were no presets at the time. So then I go, okay, well, how cool would it be if instead of tap dancing on this box, you could program several different things to come on at once and have a preset?
Right.
Okay, great. Sounds like a good idea. So I start investigating that, and this is pre-MIDI. This is like 1980, 81. There was no MIDI going on. There was no microprocessors going on for this at the time. So I came up with a scheme of using static RAM devices and flip-flops, and this is all techno jargon and everything, but still, this crazy circuit that worked, and I had memory. And I had a little coin cell battery in there and everything, and then it retained the memory. And I had presets. I had like 4 or 5 presets, and you could preset combinations. So you still, this is the key thing to my systems, is having direct access to each and every loop in the system, as well as having presets. Now, these are dedicated switches. So my boards had multiple switches on them because you had direct access to every single thing that you wanted to control. And in one instance, it might be a effect loop for a pedal or something. It might route signal somewhere or another, or do what I call control functions, which were like relay contact closures for channel switching amps.
So for these first systems, on the floor, you had a bunch of switches, but the actual effects were in the rack, right?
That's right.
Because I remember Lee said he had a drawer that had all of his little pedals in there, and he put it all in there.
And you see, that's what they are doing today. I mean, if you watch videos on Paisley or whatever, who has hundreds of effects.
It hasn't changed. Yeah. My system's in that basic concept is the same over 30 years later. Of doing this.
And everybody out there, you have to understand, there was nothing. And what you're saying is, they're literally, I mean, if you looked at early groups, they just, you know, like Hendrix had a fuzz face, a wah, and a univibe, and then he just plugged it right into the Marshall with 3 little coil cords or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
There was nothing at that time that it was even close to this type of sophistication. And I remember Lee was telling me that he's got to be able to change setups fast. So I want this phase shifter sound with with the octave box. That was one of the things he used on Deacon Blues. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, I need to be able to switch like right now.
Well, here's the thing that I was told. Now, this is early on, right? And so word of mouth happens, and I meet others via word of mouth, right? But I was told a few years into this, and I'm building systems like crazy, and primarily it was for studio guys in town because of that very reason. And I was told by some of these guys that charts were written more complex because now the guitar players didn't have to tap dance and could do things because they had preset combinations of things coming on and off. I was like, wow, that's very interesting. The fact that, you know, it changed how, you know, because I was working for studio guys. These are like guys doing, you know, film dates, anything from record dates to film dates and stuff. And it just changed things.
The early sessions, they had like 3 guitar players.
That's right.
And so they could have one guy do one thing. But later on, Lee was telling me too that just hire one guy. He would come in and he would be, they, you know, because time is money, they would have him do a bunch of overdubs or whatever, and he just have to switch. Okay, next.
The good guys, the really good guys like Lee, Michael Landau, Steve Lukather came. These guys came, Steve came to me later than some. I did stuff for Lee first. Paul Jackson Jr., massive, big rig that I built for him, one of the biggest ones back then. I just recently built another one for him. And these guys were the ones that were doing the dates. I had guys coming into me. I had Dennis Budimir come down to my place to come in just to see what I was all about. He spent like an afternoon with me just grilling me on how this all worked. He never bought a system from me, but you know, it's okay. But those guys all had the good guys that were really good had their sounds together, and that's the thing, the quickness of it. These guys, especially guys like Mike Landau, had their sounds together big time and knew how to work their gear. Some didn't. Some didn't learned wasn't might have been maybe a little more overwhelming for them to a certain extent. But the guys that knew their gear could get in there and get sounds fast.
Let me ask you, one of the people that you've worked from very early in the days is the Edge from U2, and you're working with him now. How has his system changed? I mean, he's very effects heavy. He practically invented the delay. He didn't invent it, but he made it.
He made it.
He used multiple delays. That's one of the things he did, is more than one delay.
You know? I'll say this about him. The other guys that we've just been speaking of, the effects and such were icing on the cake. With a guy like Edge, and this is not taking away from his ability as a guitar player, the effects and stuff are the cake. Mm-hmm. It's a difference. He incorporates those things into the sound, whereas it's like a lot of guys take it or leave it. You know, it's an embellishment. With him, it is the sound, which is cool. And he's super intense at dialing stuff in. He's got a crazy ear, and it's probably drove him nuts when in-ears came along and everything, because everything is now so focused in your head, and you can't get away from it on stage. It's always there. That's hard. So, you know, what I heard, and it's the same thing. I didn't do stuff for Edge until about 1991, but prior to that, several years before, they had approached me, and I got a call from, at the time, their stage manager's name was Dennis Sheehan. And Dennis, I got a call, and this is like when they're touring like October or something like that, that record. It was early, and he used one of those Boss SCC-700 things that were this multi-effect crazy thing that they made, and only had about six loops or something. But what Dennis said, which made total sense to me, is like, you can see in his face on stage that he's concentrating on this stuff, and he shouldn't be concentrating on it. He should be playing the music. He's dealing with what's coming, but he still does to this day. He knows what's coming and knows and embellishes things. But, he was someone who dove in big time and he came to me even before we were doing stuff. He would come and he would come to my shop, and I would show him how things were going. And he's a very conscientious person about all this stuff. He's careful. He's intense, really, about his sound choices and stuff.
Right.
Really cool.
What was the most elaborate setup you've ever done?
Well, his is probably one of the larger ones, but one of the earlier ones that was a lot of fun and very interesting for me was for Warren Cucurillo.
Okay.
Who, of course, was with Missing Persons and then Duran Duran. And I did stuff for Warren early on because he was another guy that loved lots of different sounds and got into stuff. And it's cool, too, because I recently, he had gone away for like, I hadn't spoken to him in like 10 years or something. Mm-hmm. And over the past, maybe 3 years ago or something, I built a new rig for him based on this pedal board approach thing that we were talking about earlier. And what this thing had was very interesting, a Yamaha mixer that had moving faders, and it was mounted in the top. It was actually mounted in a slide-out drawer type thing. You could pull it out, and you'd send MIDI program changes. This is further along now, you know, so we had MIDI at the time. So you would send MIDI program changes to it and watch the faders move and everything. But he was, like, really into it, and getting really interesting sounds was something that he was really into.
Now, some of the guys that you've had, like Landau or Buzzy, on their systems, are they still using, because, you know, now you have these, like, multi-effects units. You have the modelers like Line 6 and stuff. Are they still into those old, like a true MXR phaser or something like that? Or are they starting, are you seeing more of a trend to these modeling systems?
Nah, it varies. It really depends. That's one of the reasons why my systems were so large back then, was because you'd have an individual effect that worked great for something. Now, again, we're talking about as the dawn of the rack mount age, you might say, you know, suddenly there's these rack mount pieces coming along, and you know, as with anything, it gets There's good ones, and then there's the cheesy ones, and the ones that are just try to do too much, you know. So what you would have to do is you'd have to qualify those effects. You decide, okay, here's a multi-effect. Okay, multi-what, you know. It'll do all kinds of things. It might, 1 minute it might be doing a compressor, next minute it's doing a reverb, you know. So usually when that occurs, they haven't dedicated enough processing power or whatever to make all of them sound good. So you might use things depending upon, you know, what they are. But you know, it seems the best ones are still the ones that are single purpose things, like the old Lexicon PCM 42s, 41s. Yeah. You know, you got the Tri-Stereo Chorus, the great chorus that everybody loves and is, you know, hard to find and fetches a big dollars these days. You know, those are typically the ones that are still usable today.
Did you find yourself like taking stomp boxes and making them into racks? There was one thing you mentioned where somebody took a chorus and you made a rack mount version.
Yeah, I used to have to do that for we would take Boss CE1s were ripe for modification because they had so many things that they needed help with, you know. I tend to not like to do that. I don't like to really modify the effects per se to make it work in my system. That's one of the early things that I wanted was I wanted a patch bay type approach where you can interchange things because musicians, especially guitar players, are always changing their minds about stuff, you know. And you want to be able to take something out and not destroy it by having it work in the system. I want it to work within its from its strengths and limitations, you know. So I would be dealing with all of these different things like impedances and stuff, and then suddenly there's rack mount pieces and the trickle down from the studio rack mount pieces with all their low impedances compared to the high impedance aspects of most pedals that were guitar level stuff.
Now, Bob, we have a question actually from our live chat room on flowguitarenthusiast.com asking, we have a bass player on there, and they're asking, is there any rule of thumb with using non-bass specific pedals and effects with a bass rig when you set up those sort of things?
No, I'd say whatever works. Whatever works. I built bass rigs for people, and obviously you're dealing with the same issues that you deal with a guitar player. You know, maybe some hotter levels sometimes, depends. But I think anything goes as long as, you know, you're getting your bass tone through it. Use whatever you want. Case in point, MXR's got a killer pedal called a bass compressor. It's this white compressor. It's the best guitar compressor.
Oh, really?
I've heard. It's amazing.
Is that the one with the five knobs?
Yes, it's great.
It's, you know, it's really the one good. That I actually was watching a video of Billy Sheehan swears by it.
Yeah,
just happened to see.
And he mentioned
talking about.
They're
it,
great. They're super. So, but you know,
let me ask you something about the in terms of approach. For example, so let's take your high gain system. So, like you're working with somebody like an Eddie Van Halen or a Steve Stevens or a Joe Perry. How does that? What are the differences and the problems of a system like that? And then the studio cats like Lee or Buzzy or Michael. How did you? Was there major differences in the general design, or did it pretty much work for both?
It somewhat worked for both. My basic end of things was similar. When you're dealing with Phi or Van Halen or those kind of things, there were often more live rigs rather than studio rigs, although the lines blur. Doesn't matter. You could use it either way. It might be a little simpler stuff to use for some of these live rigs. The high gain things, what it really boiled down to was trying to, and this is the case in any system, it doesn't matter what type or what you call it, is trying as best you can to, when everything's bypassed, getting the same straight into the amp sound as you would if you were plugging straight into the amp. Now, everybody knows that that's not always going to be the case, but that's what you strive for. And that involves signal conditioning and dealing with things, the quote-unquote, the B-word buffers and things like that. I mean, if every pedal had a buffer, that may not be the greatest thing, but if no pedals had a buffer, that's not good either, you know? Mm-hmm. So you've got to have a compromise. I hate to say compromise, but you just need to know that there are certain things you got to watch out for, you know, with a high impedance guitar.
Well, I just want to let everyone know that if you want to call and ask Bob a question, 323-203-0815, 323-203-0815. We'll be taking calls after our break, and when we come back from the break, we'll be announcing the winner of the MXR 402 Boost Overdrive pedal, autographed by Bob.
We'll be back in just a second here.
Hey everybody, it's Norm from Norm's Rare Guitars. Want to thank you all at Flow Guitar Enthusiasts for helping us promote our show. We're doing a show for the homeless, the Midnight Mission, January 11th at MIT. It's going to be featuring Joe Bonamassa, Robin Ford, Jimmy Vivino, Jimmy Earle, and Grant Geisman, and more. And there's going to be some other big names, so please stay in touch with us, and we'll be happy to let you know who else is going to be on the show.
We are back. I just want to mention real quick, there was an announcement from Norm. The benefit, the date is Saturday, January 11th, 2014 at 7:30 p.m. at Musicians Institute. The name of the event is now From Hollywood with Love. It's going to be hosted by Kevin Nealon from Saturday Night Live.
Nice.
With performances by Joe Bonamassa, Robin Ford, Grant Geisman, Tony Gala, Kurt Fletcher. At this point, there's more coming. Band leaders Jimmy Vivino from Conan O'Brien and Jimmy Earle from the Jimmy Kimmel Show. So if you want, all the proceeds will be for the Midnight Mission. Tickets are available starting on November 15, 2013 at Musicians Institute at 6752 Hollywood Boulevard, Hollywood, California, 90028. If you want any more information, check out Norm's. His website, normansrareguitars.com, and you can get more information by phoning them at 818-344-8300. A great cause and an amazing night of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Well, for our listeners, I'm sure they're anxious to find out who the winner is. The winner of the pedal is Mark Holloway.
All right,
yeah,
Mark.
Mark, right on, dude.
Do you know Mark, Jeff?
No.
Oh, okay.
That's great.
Yay,
you fooled
Mark.
Me. So I'll be getting in contact with you, and we'll figure out how we can get that shipped out to you and autographed by Bob.
Watch that tone control on that thing, buddy. Keep it at 12 o'clock.
Now, getting back to pedal setups and your rack setups, a guy like Buzzy Feet, because everybody, again, check out Custom Audio Electronics website, www.customaudioelectronics.com. There's a whole article, one of your first tour gig, which was with Olivia Newton-John,
yeah,
with Buzzy and and Mike.
And Pops Popwell, man.
That's
bass.
Right. Woo. That's and it, that Panasonic rack mount system,
yeah,
that Buzzy used. Now, with guys like Landau or the studio guys, I know Rittenauer used a lot of different setups where you just use a simple amp or you would use his rack. Guys like Landau, does he use the same system he uses for the studio for his live performance, or do you have a separate system?
It's totally different ones, different stuff for each.
Okay.
Yeah, it's always, you know, it'd go back and forth, but he had different. He had a studio rack. He called the Super Cat rack, you know, and it had all his stuff in it, you know, and it was a different thing because live didn't require all of that stuff, and you know, nowadays he just uses a little pedal board.
So he doesn't use a full rack thing anymore. What about Buzzy? Does he still use his?
Don't know what Buzzy's doing.
That Panasonic rack is kind of cool.
No.
That's a great little.
Isn't that amazing?
Had a little Echoplex on the top.
Yeah, and it had we had cut out the aluminum panel cut out for all the effects on the top. That's on my latest T-shirt, man. I put that on the front.
But I noticed that you were saying before the show too that a lot of the guys now are downsizing their systems.
Absolutely.
I know that a lot of the the equipment now, they're putting it on smaller circuits, and so they can put a lot more stuff on there. But you're seeing that more. You're not seeing as much of the, I mean, except for like a Edge or something like that. You're not seeing it as much, the
It's the bigger touring acts that are still can afford to have, you know, stuff rack mounted, whether it's a rack full of pedals or not. But these days, more often than not, it's more pedal board based, because there's so many great pedals out there. There's tons of great pedals by all kinds of manufacturers, and everybody's always looking. It's the cool thing about it with pedals and such is it's real instant gratification in most cases. You know, you've got just a few knobs you're tweaking, and it's almost an impulse buy, because you can change things out easily and go, oh, here's a couple hundred bucks for a pedal that might change your life, whether you're not sinking, you know, $1,000 into a rack mount piece or something. And you know, the rack mount stuff just got a bad rap over years because so much stuff came out that was kind of crappy. And they tried to fit everything into one box, and it diluted things.
Well, one thing I knew from people that were, like, for example, we were big fans of the Eventide Instant Flanger and the Marshall Time Modulator, but they just didn't hold up. They couldn't take the beating of the road.
No, that's true. Yeah. And at Marshall Time Modulator, I had one. I mean, that thing had terminal strips on the back. It was supposed to be wired into a patch bay in a studio.
Well, yeah, well, so did the Eventide.
Yeah, that's right. It sure did. The same with the H910 did, too. I would modify those things and put quarter-inch jacks on them, wired to the terminal strips in the back of those things. And they didn't have mix knobs on them.
That's
so
right.
I would have to build mix circuits and stuff and interfaces for those things, because they were 100% wet, because they were normally used in a mix box.
Well, all that stuff was plus four, so what did you do? You had some type of interface to bring it down to
guitar level. I would bump the level up going into it and then bring it back down coming back out. And I used to have, so that's all part of the whole signal conditioning thing, where you've got to watch out for levels. And it's not just buffering, but being aware of the signal levels. There's a difference between, you know, plus four and impedances. People think low impedance means high level. It's not true.
Well, look at a microphone.
Yeah.
Microphone's not plus four.
Exactly. Microphone's, you know, plugging into a 1K input impedance.
Right.
You know, it's low impedance and tiny little signal.
So, Bob, how would you tell our listeners a good rule of thumb to determine whether they might need a buffer on their pedal board? And is there a test they can do to find out if they should put one?
Yeah, it's plugging your guitar straight into your amp and then plugging into your chain of pedals and listening for the difference. And then if you hear a difference, a muddying of the tone or something perhaps, especially with most high impedance guitar, you can really tell with Strats and stuff, and you know, humbucker guitars like Les Pauls and stuff to a certain extent. But really, my go-to is a Strat, because I can hear the chime and I'm listening for that. And it's the same thing as if you've got a 10-foot chord versus a 30-foot chord. You know, you're going to hear a muddling of the tone and a little smearing of the high end and such. You know, you might need something in there. A good choice. Everybody's not everybody, but there's a lot of different ones these days. But a good workhorse tuner is a Boss TU-2, the white one. And that's a Boss pedals are generally buffered pedals. They have active electronics. And I hate to say it's the B word. It's always the buffer thing. I should say active electronics. A lot of things have active electronics in them and can or may or may not color your tone.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the Boss pedals to see if there was anything, because, you know, a lot of people do believe they think they suck the tone because they're not true bypass. I mean,
well, you know, true bypass pedals suck your tone for sure. You go through a series of 10 true bypass pedals and you're passing your signal through all of those jacks, through some wire, through a switch in most cases, or maybe even a relay inside, because they might be true bypass, but they do it in a different way. It might not be on the switch, but it might be a relay. You go through every single one of those, not to mention the cables connecting all of them, and there's going to be tone loss no matter what. In the same way, if you put 10 Boss pedals, guitar one end, 10 Boss pedals, and out into your amp, you're especially high gain, you're going to hear a lot more hiss and stuff, because it's going to be cumulative. You're going to hear a little bit you know, on each pedal, and it builds up. Mm-hmm. Over 10 pedals, you know, it's going to build up. My client of mine, Tad Kubler with the Holt Steady, great East Coast band, really, really good rock and roll band, was amazed when he got the system that I built for him, because he had it was pretty much all Boss pedals, a whole bunch of them, you know, like half a dozen of them, I think, even. And he was amazed at the clarity that my system provided him, because my system put all of those pedals into bypass loops with only maybe one or two active stages in the signal path at all, you know, and the rest were, you know, hardwire relays, okay, passive relays. And that cleared things up tremendously for him, you know, because not only are you, with the switching system, not only are you bypassing the pedal, but you're also bypassing the cables that connect the pedal. So right. There's a whole nother batch of stuff that's getting out of your signal path. And I will maintain that a properly designed switching system is always going to sound better than you plugging through your pedals one by one and going out to your amp because of that reason.
Are there any pedals that are really popular, like let's say maybe like an old Fuzz Face or something like that, that are just problematic and just know you have to always deal with them in a certain
well,
way?
Well, yeah. I mean, and I was really happy when I listened in on your interview with Mike, Analog Mike guy.
Oh, yeah.
That was good. That was awesome. That was a really cool interview, man, because I'm going, yeah. I'm going, this guy's, yeah. I'm not sure if I've spoken to him before. I think we might have had some email correspondence here or there for mutual clients. But I was just going, right on, man. Everything that he was saying was making total sense. Though I could not dispute anything he said, which is rare. Yeah.
So
it was
really,
yeah, that was a good one. And you know, he was mentioning that about going through each and every pedal, there's going to be a loss, you know. It's going to happen.
Now, speaking of pedals, one of the things that you ended up doing throughout your career is you did mods for people. And eventually, I want to get a little bit into your pedals that you made, which are basically the more popular mods. What was like? What were the mods that you were, you know, that people were requesting?
Well, the things, when I would modify pedals, I didn't want to modify them for their to change their tonality. I wanted to modify them to make them work better in the systems that I was building. At the same time, like I said before, I didn't want to have to modify pedals because I wanted you to be able to interchange things. But a lot of times, things that would require modifications were simple things. For example, our wah pedal, a Crybaby wah pedal, had a single pole double throw switch in it, and therefore, when bypassed, your signal still fed the input circuit. It wasn't what is called these days true bypass, which is 100% bypassing of the input and the output of the circuit itself. So what happens is the output switches between the input and the output of the circuit and the input jack, while your signal still feeds the circuit. So that caused a loading of your guitar signals and such. Another problem is, so the modification was put in a double pull, double throw switch to fix that and, you know, do a quote unquote true bypass. Another thing was, oftentimes you kick a wah in, the level might drop a little bit. It'd be, oh, okay, you know, that's not good. That could be a number of things. Which is, one, the circuit itself is a filter, therefore it's filtering a lot of energy signal-wise, so which could be perceived as a lower volume. Also, the output of the wah circuit is a relatively high output impedance, and right. In my systems, you're normally at a stage position with a rack way in the back, and it could be a 50-foot run between. You've got a long cable link you've got to run. So the wah has trouble driving that line. We would put buffers in. We would buffer the B word again. We'll put an active circuit and the output to lower the output impedance to drive the line better. And those types of modifications were incorporated into like the CAE MC-404 wah that we do with Dunlop. So, and among other things, you know, one, you got a status light now, which is, these are simple things. This is all basic stuff here, but practical stuff that is necessary. You know?
Yeah.
The other thing is again, little booster pedals and stuff. The MC-401, which is built into the your guy's prize tonight, is built into the MC-402 pedal, and that is just a simple line driver booster that can give you a little bit of a lift. And it was just a fix, you know, for a lot of things. So I would build that circuit into different things that maybe needed a little help, mm-hmm. you know. So those were the modifications, really. I really didn't want to get into tonal mods or anything, because I had enough to do with just making it an integrated system and making everything work well together. So it was more practical things more than anything.
So you mainly modded their wahs a lot, and then you did some types of a buffer or a booster mm-hmm. to give them more gain.
Yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
you never were called upon like to modify their phasers or their flangers or...
Not so much.
Okay.
You know, well, you know, not tonally. I didn't want to get into that. You know,
okay.
A good example though is like the Boss CE1 chorus, the one we were talking about, the rack mount. Well, and this comes from Paul Rivera knew this. Paul Rivera had this great CE1 mod that he did, and he even put a new little sticker on the top and everything. He added a depth control to the chorus side and buffered it.
Mm-hmm.
Because those things have a real low impedance, and guitar players using them would go, oh, my tone sucked down, because you know it's a 50k ohm pot. The input level control is a 50k pot. A guitar can't drive that, and a lot of effects back then couldn't drive that either, because they had relatively high output impedance. So
when you work with these companies like MXR, and I think you've worked with Rocktron too, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Do you specify the parts that they use, or you just kind of give them a schematic and say, here you go, do it?
No, I leave that to them, because they're the manufacturer, and we hopefully agree on what components are used, you
mm-hmm.
know, and to a certain extent, yeah, but, you know, the wah thing was, these are my basic changes to the wah, you know, and it was simple stuff, though. It's not, no rocket science here, but these are the things that made up a wah that was modified by, you know, Custom Audio Electronics. So they incorporate those things. But I let them. They put the parts in them on everything. You know, they spec that, because they know what to do with that kind
mm-hmm.
of thing.
The one last thing, because we're almost at the end of the show. You ended up doing amp design too. Was that because of what people wanted? You were modding amps, right?
Well, that's another story. You got time?
We got a couple of minutes. Definitely, we're going to have you back. We haven't even.
Oh,
we, that.
Yeah, yeah. But all the amps and stuff it was solving a problem. And I should preface this by saying that the amp mods and stuff were born primarily out of the development of the CAE 3+2 preamp. That came about because my friend Steve Lukather was carting around all over the world when I was touring with him at the time too. We were carting around a Mesa Boogie amp for a clean sound, a Marshall 100 watt amp for a crunch sound, and a Soldano SLO-100 for his lead sound. These are three amplifiers that were in loads or load boxes, and this is back when we were doing it that way, and then through power amps, because that's another topic we didn't even get into. But these were all basically used as preamps, and the freight was insane. It's another problem that we have today, is the whole freight thing. So I commissioned Mike Soldano to... build me a three-channel 2 preamp. I even gave him the chassis to put it for my switching systems. I gave him the chassis to build this up, and I said, okay, here's the deal. I want a Fender twin-like clean sound. I want a Marshall crunch sound, like a Plexi-type crunch sound, and then your SLO-100 lead channel. Okay. He came out with this thing called the X88R. He built me the prototype. I own the prototype. I didn't even tell Steve Lukather that I was having it built. I did it on my own, then presented mm-hmm. it to him and said, check this out, man. Look at this. He fell in love with it. and used it for years, but it was mine. I own that thing. And anyway, subsequently, Mike made these prints. He got a nice little revenue stream out of this thing. And he'd sell them to me for $100 off. And I'm like, wait a minute. Let's rethink this a little bit. Meantime, I struck up a friendship with John Sir because he was buying a system from me. And meantime, he was in New York building guitars out of Rudy's Music. And on the side, getting into amp design and stuff. And he was like deep into it, modding Marshalls and everything and doing this. And I said, look, we got to come out with a new preamp. Because, number one, the Soldano wasn't exactly, it was great, but it wasn't enough. It had limitations that we wanted to address. And we did. And so John said, let's jump on this. So we create this, John and I created the 3 Plus 2 preamp. And subsequently, he moved out here to California. We developed this preamp, which I still build to this day. And from that, that stemmed all the amp mods and stuff. And John developed these amplifier mods that he was doing. And then we said, okay, well, the next logical step is let's build an amp. And so we started coming up. And based on aspects of the 3 Plus preamp, we came up with the OD100 amp, which subsequently now John manufactures to this day. I don't have anything to do with it anymore.
Okay. But it makes sense. I mean, to have a Marshall Fender,
but you know,
so I don't have to buy all those amps.
Yeah, either. Well, see, all of these things that I do are born out of practical need, you know. And the reason I build these systems to this day, there's a lot of people out there doing this kind of stuff now. There wasn't anything out there back then when I started doing it. Nothing like what I was doing, and therefore I had to build it myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm one of these few guys that are still out there that still builds the hardware. A lot of guys that call themselves rig builders and stuff that, you know, buy off-the-shelf stuff. I build them I still custom build them, but I'm working on another line of off-the-shelf mm-hmm. routers and stuff, too, that are coming up.
Yeah, so. Well, your amp switcher's a killer.
That's another one.
Well, would you be seeing something like that at NAMM in January?
Not quite, no.
It's too early?
Yeah, a little too early. It takes time.
Well, we're at the end of the show, and actually, we're running over, but it's as usually happens, we haven't even touched the surface of what you do. So that just means we're just going to have you back.
I'm in, man.
That's
Come
it.
On. Let's do it.
So anyway, I just want to thank you again. It's truly a pleasure. Everybody in the chat room is just going nuts, loving what you were talking about. And we got to come back and talk about the using the amp as a preamp, that whole system.
Oh, man, I got all kinds of stories for you there,
yes.
Man.
So anyway, I just wanted to thank you again. It's truly a pleasure.
And thank Aaron from Taylor Guitars.
Yes.
And next week we have TV Jones, the pickup manufacturer, and he makes guitars too.
Awesome.
So.
Yes, all you Gretsch guys. That's the pickup. That's the hot pickup for Gretches. So, but anyway, yes, everybody have a great week. Thanks again, Bob.
You bet.
And we will be talking with you and TV Jones next week.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.